show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to Tuesday, the 20th day of August 2013. Titanic Tuesday rolls around again on the horn. This is the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. We like to call what we do here conversation radio. Easily available at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com as well as a number of other streaming links via WhiteRoseSociety.org and the subdomain for this program. There you will also find the podcast feed address for the program. And you can get the podcast also at iTunes. If you're on a mobile device, a smart device, a tablet device, what have you, we recommend the TuneIn Radio app as well as Stitcher. It's just a matter of taste. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find both the PayPal button for supporting the program and helping to keep us all afloat, as well as the traditional overland mail address. That address, by the way, is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V 25801. Remember, checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but rather should be made payable to Head On Communications, The Horn, something like that, because, well, Bob doesn't get the money. I am high, Bob Kincaid. No, I'm not high. I'm just Bob Kincaid. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll get this sorted out yet. Good gracious. It is Titanic Tuesday on the horn. Titanic Tuesday named for the Titanic wit apparent, the Titanic intellect apparent in the operations and machinations of the right wing. And I have happy news to report. Thanks indeed to Sal. And thanks to Barry. And thanks to Janie. Betsy's "Hey, I got a new job" challenge was met last night and today. Thank you very kindly. So we will begin. We are still in a bit of a hole. Now, it's not something where you can fall in and not be able to climb out. We're still in somewhat of a hole, though, as far as keeping up with fundraising is concerned. And we can go a long way toward filling that hole in by responding to Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge, which rolls around this evening. $150 on the table. And if that is matched, then we will be a long way toward getting out of the hole. So thank you very much, and thanks very much, Jan and Jerry, jumping in this evening. It is much appreciated, helping us to get the evening started. And that means that we've only got $130 to go to finish off Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Excellent. That's a great way to get started. Thank you very, very much. It is, like I said, Titanic Tuesday, and I have this notion. Well, you know, you see things and they sort of form up, whether they're real or not, and I acknowledge that it may entirely be in my head. Consider this a tale of two Utes. Two what, counselor? Utes. These two Utes. And they're both Republicans, and they're kind of far apart. One slightly older than the other, but folks that, from my vantage point, look younger than I, obviously. Let's start in Iowa, where the Polk County GOP chairman ran 10 yards back from center, hollered hike, and punted. Chad Brown is 34 years old from Ankeny, Iowa. Am I pronouncing that wrong? Probably. Ankeny, Jonesville, A-N-K-E-N-Y, Iowa. Well, he sent a little letter to the Polk County Republican Party. Here's the text of the letter. Dear Polk County GOP Executive Committee member, and this comes from, by the way, the Des Moines Register. Dear Polk County GOP Executive Committee member, I'm writing to inform you that I changed my voter registration to independent today. Going all the way to Democrat, that's just a bridge too far, isn't it? I'm writing to inform you that I changed my voter registration to independent today, severing all ties to the Republican Party. Having been a Republican all my life, I did not take this decision lightly. Having spoken with a pastor, oh, sweet Jesus, really? Yeah, whatever. Having spoken with a pastor and having prayed about this for hours, shut up, Bob. I came to the conclusion that this is my only recourse. I'm disappointed with the Republican Party at the national level. I'm disappointed with the Republican Party at the statewide level. I'm disappointed with the Republican Party at the countywide level. I find it increasingly difficult to defend issues and statements made by party leaders and officials from all three levels. I decided to get back in this arena following the contentious 2012 Polk County GOP convention. I was upset by what happened at the conventions, and I entered into the arena with the intent to help fix the problems. However, I think this level of dysfunction is not going to be fixed anytime soon. I donated time and financial resources to the Polk GOP and haven't had a good return on my investment, because that's the way Republicans think. It's all about return on investment and quarterly profit and loss statements, and, well, you get the idea. In the 2000 presidential election, the Polk GOP lost Polk County, and he makes a compelling statement here. By the way, thank you very kindly to Bernice for helping us move along this evening. We are now at 120 for what we need to raise in the remaining $120 for the remainder of the evening. Thank you very much, Bernice. He says, I donated time and financial resources to the Polk GOP, haven't had a good return on my investment. In the 2000 presidential election, the Polk GOP lost Polk County by about 16,000 votes. In the fall of 2000, the Polk GOP had no headquarters. The Polk GOP had no paid staff. The Polk GOP didn't even have a working telephone number. Fundraising was minimal. In 2012, the Polk GOP lost Polk County by over 32,000 votes. Until 2002, Republicans were elected to the State House from Des Moines. In 2012, Republicans lost two State House seats in suburban Republican-leaning districts and came two dozen votes from losing a third. Facts are stubborn things. He's sort of sideways quoting Ronald Reagan there, a hero of all Republicans, St. Ronnie of Reagan, who actually said, deep in the throes of Alzheimer's disease with little worms running through his brain, "Yeah, well, mommy, facts are stupid things." But no, facts are stubborn things. I think we are now headed in the wrong direction on several fronts and regretfully must step aside. It's my opinion that rather than fix the problems that led to such a massive 2012 defeat, the GOP does not seem to seriously want to fix the issues. I think helping a dysfunctional party that does not want to address its problems is enabling. I do not believe in enabling. I debated this for weeks and am certain this is the only course. I wish you the best of luck. Signed, Chad Brown. And Chad Brown said he's disgusted with the Republican Party. He was interviewed by the Des Moines Register. And he said the GOP has declared war on science and common sense by denying global climate change. Well, hello. And he said he was offended by statements from some party leaders that he felt glorified gun violence. Ted Nugent. And he said that he was disgusted by Representative Steve King, he of the Cantaloupe Calves, and complained about the fact that nobody would really stand up against him in Iowa. No one stood out to really fight him on those. I think they're just hateful statements. I think Chad Brown sounds like he's preparing for a congressional run, don't you? He says the party has been co-opted by the Christian right and the National Rifle Association. He is right on both counts. And so that's Chad Brown of Ankeny, Iowa. Let's get back in the car and head south now. Let's head really south, especially from a place like Iowa, kind of down the Mississippi and turn left at Memphis to Alabama, Stan. It was back in June when Stephanie Petelos, who was the chair of the College Republican Federation of Alabama and a former president of the University of Alabama College Republicans, the capstone, one of my former alma maters. Well, she said she was a little put out with all the hateful yammering and the religious overtones of the Republican Party leaders in her state. And in particular, she took a swipe at the state party GOP platform regarding marriage equality. And she told a newspaper in Alabama, well, it's all at AL.com. She said, "The majority of students don't derive the premise of their argument for or against gay marriage from religion because we're governed by the Constitution and not the Bible." I think a lot of people would be actively for it meaning marriage equality, if they didn't live in fear of backlash from party leaders. We don't want to go against the party. We love the party. We're just passionate about a whole list of other issues. That's why we're involved. Okay. I'm probably not going to share a whole lot of ideological space beyond that with Stephanie Petelos anytime soon. But Lordy, oh my God, get out the fainting couch and the smelling salts. Because word reached the Alabama GOP, and they wasn't having none of it. No. So the state Republican Party in Alabama got together, and they decided to amend their bylaws. Because the College Republican chairwoman sits on the advisory board, governing board, whatever, and they introduced an amendment to the bylaws to get rid of her. We don't need people talking about how we don't want politics not being run by God. What does she mean? We make our political determinations based on the Constitution and not on religion. Don't she know this here is Alabama, Stan? Mercy sakes. So she struck a deal with the Alabama Republican Party. And this is, in a way, it sort of, I don't know, maybe it doesn't. You can almost see a geographic divide in how folks think. Now, it doesn't get any weirder than being a Republican in Iowa, especially with another election rolling around here in a couple of years. What's his name? Scott Brown, former Playgirl centerfold. Ooh, the staple. I hate it when they put the staple in. Ouch! not that I've ever been a Playgirl centerfold. But Scott Brown, centerfold and former member of the United States Senate for ever so brief a time, who got his ass handed to him, Scott, is this yours, by Elizabeth Warren, has been toddling, lo and behold, well, Michelle wasn't there, and sad but true, Marcus wasn't there, working over the corn dogs, but yes, indeedy, the obligatory photograph of Scott Brown of Massachusetts was taken with a corn dog about halfway down his throat out there at the state fair, looking at hogs and such like. It doesn't get any more weirdly Republican, and granted, all these little Clavering meetings are weird, but it doesn't get any more weirdly Republican than dear old Iowa. Iowa, which I have noted in the past, for which I have a soft spot, because land in Iowa was sold off to the highest bidder to raise the money to build the first buildings that went on to become Harvard on the Monongahela, otherwise known as my alma mater, West Virginia University. Someday I hope to see that plot of land just to say, well, thanks. But anyway, so Iowa Republicans aren't known as being a bunch of, tea sippers. No, they're guzzlers. They're tea guzzlers. There's a lot of tea partying going on in Iowa. You get the idea. But Chad Brown, no relation to Scott, stood up square and said, I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm going to go over and register and be me an independent. Because I can't stand the war on science, the war on women, the denial of climate change, and Steve King's a weirdo. Pretty brass bound statement there. Statements that wouldn't you say? Contrast that with Stephanie Petelos, who, when confronted with the proposed amendment in Alabama, sponsored by Don Wallace of Tuscaloosa and Bonnie Sachs of Double Springs, the amendment says nobody can continue to serve on the steering committee of the Alabama GOP if they publicly advocate a position contrary to the platform adopted at the Republican National Convention. And if they're removed in order to be reinstated, they have to publicly rescind their comments. And so they reached an agreement with Stephanie Petelos. And the agreement was that she will shut the f*** up about all that business about America, about our country being ruled by the Constitution and not the Bible. The brief statement she gave to AL.com was, the only thing I have to say is that I had an agreement with GOP leaders to not discuss the gay marriage issue further, and they agreed to drop the issue and stop trying to remove my position, so I'm going to continue upholding my agreement with them. She knuckled under. She cared more about her position with the Alabama GOP steering committee than she did about whether or not she was speaking truth to power. Not exactly a well-known Republican trait in the first place. Speaking truth to power about the essential constitutional rights that are denied every day to same-sex couples inside Alabama Stan and, well, other Stan states. Well, most of the country. So we see a little difference about the power of personal conviction. And we also see the ongoing, I don't think it's the demise of the Republican Party, just the change in it. Because a long, long time ago, I espoused a theory, and I don't know if it has any validity to it, maybe it absolutely doesn't. In a discussion, and I remember a number of these discussions regarding third party politics in this country and whether or not it's viable. The argument that I made is that for as long as the electoral system in this country remains what it is, i.e. first past the post, that we will have a two-party system, because we do not have a parliamentary system such as is in place in old Canada, Great Britain, Australia, Germany, France, Japan. We don't have a system that rewards direct participation and direct vote counts, so that you can have multiple parties represented in the legislative body, in particular in a parliamentary system. We have a bicameral legislature with a first-past-the-post system that where there's no proportional representation. And as such, I argued and continue, and I maintain this position. It has not yet been shown to be false, and I think the nature of my my argument is that it will, in fact, be shown more and more true as time goes on, that instead of seeing the rise of a third party that then competes as, you know, as a third party with the other two, what you see over the history of the United States is the absorption of one moribund party into a more dynamic movement. We saw that as the Whigs and the Know-Nothings and various other small factions converged and coalesced into the Republican Party. In the early days of this country, we saw how the Republican Party morphed into what became known by the time of Andrew Jackson as the Democratic Party. And when you look at the stories of Ms. Petelos and Mr. Brown, Ms. Petelos in Alabama and Mr. Brown in Iowa, you begin to see the modern manifestation, I think, of that theory in action. To wit, people tend to talk about the Republican Party and the Tea Party as if they are separate entities. They aren't. You know, there was no big blinking sign. Well, there was no electricity at the time. I mean, there was, but it hadn't been captured and harnessed and generated. Never mind. There was no big blinking sign that was put up that said, Whig Party going out of business. Republican Party buying property. It just happened. In fact, well into the presidency of the first term of the presidency, and perhaps into the second term of the presidency of Abraham Lincoln, there were still Whigs. Abraham Lincoln himself was a Whig. But in order to triangulate the fractious power struggle that was taking place in the 1850s in the United States, in which Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats couldn't agree, and in which America's first gay president, James Buchanan, couldn't do anything, the Republicans became ascendant by virtue of coalition building, because of the new so-called Republican movement, born in a log cabin in Wisconsin, if I recall correctly. Well, the same is taking place today. And I got to thinking about this last night when we were having rather a jolly discussion over in Malloy's chat room about Julian Assange, and I referenced him the other night, Julian Assange's statement that the right-wing libertarian Republicans represent the last best hope for democracy in the U.S. And I really did get to thinking about it. And it occurred to me that there's no... And maybe I'm just stating the obvious, or not, but there is no effective difference between the Republican Party and the Tea Party. I would even go so far as to say the Tea Party now is the Republican Party. Those old line rock-ribbed Republicans who occasionally might come to some sort of an agreement with a staunch Democrat of decent conservative values, you know what I'm getting at. Those guys are in the minority now, and they are fast becoming an endangered species. witnessed what happened in Utah, what happened in Indiana, and what may very damned well happen in Tennessee and Kentucky. Mitch McConnell is going to be primaried. And in Tennessee, Lamar Alexander is going to be primaried by a Tennessee member of the House of Representatives who thinks that Senator Alexander isn't being sufficiently nasty to brown people. The Republican Party is transforming. And the question is whether or not we will have the gumption to recognize it as it happens. Right, yeah. No blinking lights when the Whigs went out of business, Irish Dave reminding me. That's only because it was B.C., before coal. When there weren't no lights, we couldn't see the sign with Hope and God headquarters that read, "Now under new management." Just saying. I get it, Irish Dave. I get it. But it's worth considering. Chad Brown in Polk County, Iowa, becomes an independent. Stephanie Petelos in Alabama closes her trap because she is female, it's Alabamistan, and she has been told to shut the F up if she wants to continue being tolerated. So just one of those little, signposts along the way. And by the way, thanks going out to Chris. Thank you, Chris. He just helped us get down the road towards Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. We are now at $110 to get to our fundraising goal for the evening. Chris sending a note along saying, "Tiny contribution long overdue. Thanks, Bob, and the entire Horn Commune for the best 3 hours a day I spend." Well, Chris, thank you, and it's not tiny, and there's no such thing as tiny. And you and folks like you and Bernice and Janie and Barry and Sal and Jan and Jerry and Betsy, you're the ones who are helping to make sure those 3 hours continue to exist. But like I said, a little signpost. Just one of those things that we notice along the way that tell us things are not exactly as we might think they are. But the thing is, as we watch the transformation of the Repig-Lickin' Party, do not labor under the illusion that somehow or another this country is going to be any better off, because this bunch is no less dysfunctional than their ideological. Well, they are more dysfunctional. Goodness gracious. The libertarians are the last best hope for democracy in the United States. Just keep on letting that one rattle around and around and around. And well, you get the idea. And speaking of signposts, I still have in the back of my mind the story coming out of, what county was it in Tennessee, where the fire department showed up to watch a man's house burn to the ground and didn't put a drop of water on it because, he didn't pay his fire fee. And shortly thereafter, there were stories out of the Dakotas about roads being returned to gravel because, thanks to, folks like Tea Partiers, confiscatory taxes, yeah, we can't stand them. put up another one of those signposts. You can put these signposts in Texas. The Texas Tribune reporting that as a result, approximate result of the oil and gas boom in Texas, that, well, consequences are beginning to be felt. This comes as no surprise to me because I live in a state where we have overweight, massive killer coal trucks running up and down the road at all hours of the day. And they're not supposed to run at night, but you see a lot of them on the road on the way home. And they're twice as scary then because maybe they're not even loaded anymore. And they're, well, they can really get up a full head of steam then. And what people are learning out in West Frakistan is that the fracking industry also uses heavyweight vehicles that tear up the public commons, destroy the public commons. And as a result of fracking in Texas, the state of Texas, Texas Department of Transportation, according to the Texas Tribune, has begun converting paved roads back to gravel. The new speed limit will be 30 miles per hour on the gravel roads. This is because the fracking trucks and the various service trucks and so forth have torn the living bejesus out of Texas's roads. And, well, Texas doesn't like to spend money on things like roads, and they don't like federal taxes either, bearing in mind, of course, that Texas gets a whole lot more in money back from the federal government than they ever put in, just like the other stand states. But in the middle of being entirely obsessed with the workings of women's insides, well, the Texas legislature, when it met, could only come up with $225 million for road and bridge repair this year. They also approved a ballot measure that will go to the voters. Guess how that's going to work? That'll provide $1.2 billion a year for state transportation projects. That doesn't come around until 2014, however. And that's money that comes out of Texas's so-called rainy day fund, of which there aren't many, into the state highway fund. But because there wasn't enough money appropriated to take care of the roads that the God-sent, the sacred fracking vehicles are destroying, Texas is getting some brand new gravel roads. Because for all intents and purposes, after the fracking vehicles, much as is the case with coal trucks, have run over them, they turn into gravel anyway. And then they say, look at the economic prosperity what we done brung you. Look at all this shiny white gravel. The shortfall between the $225 million appropriated and that which is needed for Texas to go on living in the 21st century and having paved roads. I mean, for Christ's sakes, the Romans had paved roads 2,200 years ago. Well, they're about $175 million short. Because it's your money. Right? A spokesman for the Texas Department of Transportation by the name of David Glessner told the Texas Tribune, since paving roads is too expensive and there is not enough funding to repave them all, our only other option is to make them safer is to turn them into gravel roads. And here now is the gambling portion of tonight's Titanic Tuesday. Would anyone care to bet how many fracking heavy fracking vehicles will actually adhere to the 30-mile-an-hour brand-new Texas gravel road speed limits? I didn't think you would. Because, well, they're not gonna. More economic prosperity from fracking. And since we're in Texas, let's stay there. And I can't wait to see Texas. I've wanted to see Texas all my life, and I get to in the middle of next month. And so if you can make it to Waco, in the middle of the month, the 13th. I think that's Friday the 13th. As soon as Dr. Allen sends me the flyer, I'll share it around. But be doing a little talk about mountaintop removal there in Waco. And if we've never met, I'd love to meet you. So come on out if you can. No, but since that fracking that's doing Texas out of modern amenities like paved roads, well, it's doing Texas out of other things, too. As a result of the fracking that has happened with a sort of Wild West glee, count them, 30 towns in Texas may very well be learning in the all-too-near future that they don't have water anymore. I mentioned the other night how much I loved reading Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. And those first couple of chapters that describe life in Lonesome Dove, West Texas, dusty and dry and baked, form a sort of, and I know all of Texas is not like that. Big daggum place. But it sort of creates a sort of mental space. As did, for instance, the Paul Newman vehicle back when I was a little boy that was called The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, Law West of the Pecos. More than 30 towns in West Texas will be out of water. They're going to be out of water because their underground water supplies have been diverted for fracking. Because fracking takes an awful lot of water, and the water you take for fracking cannot be returned for consumption by humans at all. 30 towns. Oh, by the way, when they take the water, they do replace it. They just don't replace it. The frackers don't. They don't replace it with water. They take the water and they replace it with arsenic. And this is... This is them job creators, isn't it? 30 towns, no water. How you reckon those teabagging types? I mean, what are they going? Are they going to make their patriotic tea with arsenic? Was it? Tastes a little like almonds or something, or is that cyanide? I can't remember. Well, hell, we're talking about fracking. There's probably some cyanide involved, too. No, I'm not going to cue up the Sons of the Pioneers singing Cool Water. Story comes from a website called Gas2. Gas2.org. Joe Boris is the author of the story there. Texas is fracked. More than 30 towns will be out of water due to fracking. Now, I have to tell you that it's a... I'm not going to say that. I grieve. My heart is made sad. Not too long back, we talked a little bit. Irish Dave, as a matter of fact. The road to hell is paved with fracking gravel, and we should go long in gravel futures. Might not be a bad idea. Dusty business, that gravel, though. And yes, I know, Irish Dave, it's a well-known true fact that we don't need no fracking speed limits. Maka writes in, and thank you very much. Hope this helps with the challenge today, Bob. Don't have much money. The res is kind of poor, you know, but I hope this helps. It all does. It helps immensely. And there's, like I said, that's a ton. And we are now, we're knocking it on down. $95 now, if I've got my math on the fly, is all that remains of tonight's challenge from Shirley in Wisconsin. And by the way, I've got a note here from Robert in Australia. He's responding to the story of Chris Lane toward the end of the program last night, the young baseball player from Australia who was shot to death in Oklahomistan by some kids who just wanted to see what it looked like when another human being died. And Robert in Australia says, in reference to yesterday's program, I'm listening on podcast, Australia is not a gun culture. The majority of Australians do not own firearms of any type. The majority of Australians do not want to own firearms. In Australia, it makes the news when a police officer fires his weapon, and that's often followed by a Royal Commission inquiry as to why it was fired if someone has actually been shot. So when an Australian is shot and killed while out jogging in the USA, it is shocking to Australians. We just don't understand it. We find it impossible to accept. And I almost think that unless I'm wrong, Robert, that probably barely even scratches the surface. Impossible to accept. I think under those circumstances, at some point in time, people outside the United States in positions of power, say Kevin Rudd, for instance, should take to his bully pulpit and ask the American people, why? What in God's name is wrong with you? Why? Why do you value putting firearms in the hands of 15, 16, and 17-year-old little killers and taking the life away of a perfectly decent 22-year-old young man whose only goal was to play American baseball? Why? Why is it more? And keep asking that question, even when they stand up and they holler, because freedom, Wolverines! Keep asking, yeah, but why? Why is it more important for some... And it's about time that people started being mean about it, nasty about it. I'm sure Kevin Rudd is entirely too urbane and sophisticated to do this, but to ask the American people, and especially American males, why is it you feel so penilely insufficient that you have to extend them with blue steel firearms? Well, because like tyranny. And with every stupid answer promulgated by the NRA or one of their paid hacks or flacks, push the question a little further. See, that's the thing, Robert. I'm an American, and I don't understand it either. And I find it impossible to accept. And a lot of us do. But a lot of Americans, are perfectly willing to swap Chris Lane so that somebody can feel sexually sufficient or something. Irish Dave asking, has the Australian government issued a travel advisory yet? You know what? That should happen. I know, Dave's probably funning a little bit, but that's the truth. If every country with civilized firearm laws in this country, or in this world, was to issue a travel advisory about travel to the United States, warning, you may be randomly gunned down in the United States of America simply for being a human being in the wrong place at the wrong time, because that country cannot be trusted to safely deal with its firearm fetish, it might begin to make a difference. You reckon Disney World might get a little upset if they're... Because people come from all over the world to go to Disney World and Disneyland. Reckon a few phones might start getting dialed to a few Congress people. Say, listen, business, international travel business is down 35% because of the goddamn guns. Kind of makes sense, doesn't it? So, Robert, if you don't mind, I would appreciate it if you would sort of keep us up to date on the response there to this manifest horror. I mean, how's about maybe the Kevin Rudd calling the American ambassador in on the carpet and just chewing his ass out for a while? What kind of barbarian operation are you running over there? I mean, we're friends and all, but Jesus! Second part of Robert's note. He said, due to a dental visit not covered under Medicare, car registration, and compulsory third-party insurance, all of which took place this month, I'm unable to make my usual 20th of the month down under challenge. And Robert... please, thank you so much for all that you have. And he says, so the challenge this month is for five other people to each donate $50. And I'll be back next month, teeth allowing. So thank you, Robert. Thank you for that. Thank you. Robert has been an absolute pillar and stalwart. And if folks would respond to Robert's challenge, it would be deeply helpful. Yeah, Marty with a query. He says, remember when visitors to Florida were being jacked, robbed, and killed just leaving the airport? Were there any travel alerts then? No. But it's about time there were. Kind of like blackboxing a drug. Warning! You are about to leave for the United States of America. Those people can't be trusted with firearms. They can't be trusted not to hurt themselves. And they may just as well kill you. Marty asking, follow-up on the murdered Australian, how many of these bored Oklahomans were black? I don't know. I do not know. Randy in PA noting, Disney World is located in Rick Scott's, Florida. How do you think that the Disney Corp feels about that? Well, they banned firearms in Disney theme parks, and the NRA and the concealed carry awful gun owners, oh, they had a hissy. Yeah. Well, got a couple of stories here. And let's do these now instead of right at the end of the program so that I don't, so that I and you and we don't end the program going, F, where's the chloroform? Dateline, Dundee, Michigan. This is the story of Joshua Greenhill, 30 years old, charged in the First District Court in Monroe, Michigan, with careless discharge of a firearm causing injury or death. It's a misdemeanor that can carry up to 2 years in the county pokey. It's not even a prison offense. It's not even a felony. Why was 30-year-old Joshua Greenhill charged thusly? 30-year-old Joshua Greenhill is, of course, an awful gun owner. I mean, lawful gun owner. Heck, he had himself a concealed carrying permit. For all I know, in Michigan, you can stand women. Stand your ground. Had himself a concealed carry permit, this 30-year-old protector of freedom. Wolverines! And he got, I guess, carrying his concealed weapon got to be a little wearisome for Joshua Greenhill. Because it can kind of unbalance you, even if it's a shoulder holster, or maybe you got it in the small of your back, or on one hip or the other, but you can kind of walk with a wobble after it. Damn things can be heavy, them freedom-protecting shooting irons. So, since he was tired, he took his freedom-protecting shooting gun Second Amendment remedy, and he laid it on the floor of a closet. Yes, it was a closeted firearm. Enter Oh, God. Enter a 3.5-year-old little boy who did what 3.5-year-old little boys do. He went looking about, opening doors, closing doors, going to another door, opening a door, and he just happened to open the closet door where 30-year-old lawful gun owner Joshua Greenhill, concealed permit carrier, ground stander, had put his firearm. And the curious little 3.5-year-old fella got it and blew his own brains out. After the horror had taken place, after the installment payment on America's obscene butcher's bill had been paid, three-and-a-half-year-old little fella's daddy went on Facebook, and he wrote the following. Yesterday, I lost my third son, Yesterday, I lost my 3-year-old son to a gun accident. We are all hoping to wake up from this nightmare, though we know that it is now a living nightmare. My baby boy is gone, and I will never get to hold him again. I will miss him terribly. Brian Holbrook was the little fella's daddy. And he said it was all because the pistol wasn't security. Continued, I have nothing wrong with guns. It's with this, and this is direct from Facebook, so it's with this country was built on. I presume he meant it's what this country was built on. I will still support the Second Amendment, he wrote. All I ask is that everyone please, safety first, lock it up, and put it out of reach of anyone that has no business being around a gun, especially kids. Gun safety, people. My boy would still be here if it was put away like it should have been. Thank you for all the prayers and well wishes. See, in America, even when your little three-year-old little fella, little son, has just blown his own brains out with the unsecured pistol left lying on a closet floor by a 30-year-old lawful gun owner, freedom protector, concealed carrier, even when that happens, you still have to say, but I support the Second Amendment. If you don't mind my saying so, can I be really clear about something? I don't support the Second Amendment. I think the Second Amendment is a godforsaken anachronism of the 18th century. The Second Amendment is a slavery amendment that was included in the Bill of Rights at the insistence of a bunch of goddamn Southern slave owners so that they could take firearms and go hunt down runaway slaves the same way they'd hunt deer in the woods in autumn. I do not support the Second Amendment. I think the Second Amendment is sickening. I think the Second Amendment is disgusting. I think the Second Amendment is putrescent. I think it is blood-sodden. I think it is filthy. I think it is the nastiest blight that afflicts this poor, poor, blood-soaked country. Clear? And I think all of that because the people who reverence the Second Amendment lay their goddamn guns on closet floors or put them in bedside night table drawers where 3.5-year-olds and 5-year-olds find them. That's why I despise the Second Amendment.
Yeah, but what about tyranny?
Shh. So there's that. And then, well, then there's another one, sad to say. All too sad to say. Remember we had the story last night of the little 11-year-old girl in Tennessee asking former physician and patient fornicator Scott Desjarlais why she couldn't have her daddy to love? And we got laws and we got to follow them laws and we're going to send your daddy away. Well, this story's out of Henderson County, Tennessee. A report via WBBJ-TV. It's the story... Oh, God. It's the story of 48-year-old Terry York and his 12-year-old son, Luke. Forty-eight-year-old Terry York was having some buddies over, and he was demonstrating his gun. He wasn't demonstrating. He's just showing them off a little bit. He was in the back room of the house, showing his AR-15 rifle, you know, the same one that chewed a rather substantial number of little children at Newtown, Connecticut, into tiny, tiny pieces. He was showing his AR-15 rifle, you know, that Obama, he's stockpiling guns and bullets because he's got to use a race army and they're going to come after us and put us in the FEMUR camps. Now, we don't know that Mr. York was like that. It's just Tennessee, that's all. And all the report says is that his AR-15 rifle, which was being kept inside the house, accidentally discharged. Just kind of like the pistol on the closet in Dundee, Michigan, was accidentally discharged. As the gun goobs are so wont to say, guns don't kill people, people kill people. And unless it's just like the story of the woman in Florida, who had that gold-plated 25 caliber pistol that Daddy done give her in case she ever was in had to stand her ground and protect freedom, and she dropped it on the floor at Starbucks and shot her buddy in the leg. Unless it was one of those situations. Whoops, I dropped my AR-15. And then it just went off. Unless it was that, that means that the gun was loaded and probably had a round in the chamber, because you know, you never know when the Obama relocation deep-seated hatred of white people muzzling Kenyan army is going to come a-busting through. So he was showing his AR-15 to some buddies back in the back room of the house. Yeah, you know how it is with the back room of the house. Some folks have a radio studio. Other people have a godforsaken arsenal. Mr. York had an arsenal. And according to the Tennessee State Bomb and Arson Investigators, job-killing regulators, on Sunday afternoon, whilst showing off his AR-15, the gun accidentally discharged. We don't really have a working definition for that term, accidentally discharged, but we do know the end results. It accidentally discharged and started a small fire in the back room. More questions, I know, but you take what you can get from journalism in America today. The small fire in the back room didn't look like it was going to be any particular problem, except that it became one. And it became one when 12-year-old Luke came into the back room there, and all of a sudden a whole bunch of ammunition started going off. No report here on what happened to the folks who were in the room, who were in the room having the AR-15 shown off to them, because the only people who died in that hail of bullets were, of course, 48-year-old Terry York and his 12-year-old son, Luke. Neighbor Kathleen Glass said, the explosions were just like one right after another, one explosion right after another. I just don't have the words for it, because I cannot imagine having to go through something like this. York had apparently stored what is described scientifically as a lot of ammunition in the room where the fire started. Now, why would you need to store a lot of ammunition in the room? Anybody? This is the romper room segment of the program. Yeah, I see Betsy, and I see Waggy, and I see Sparky, right? And we wonder, I mean, really? A lot of ammunition? More than two or three boxes for going out and plinking at your leftover beer cans on a Sunday down to the range, and freedom protecting society? Why would you stockpile a bunch of God blessed ammunition? Why? Oh, wait, because the NRA, for going on 6-7 years now, has hollered, buy all the bullets you can, that Kenyan Muslim is going to come and take away your guns and make it harder to get the bullets, and he's stockpiling bullets, too. I understand, Irish Dave. Irish Dave pointing out, I don't have to tell you, the West wasn't one with a registered backroom ammo dump. If it was anything but firearms, and we proved that we just couldn't be around them safely, wouldn't we probably have done something about it by now? No, you know, freedom! Thanks, Danny. Danny noting, Danny writing from Louisiana, Stan. Go, Bob, go. Thanks. Danny spells go in that classic Louisiana Stan style that I love so well, G-E-A-U-X, as in Go Tigers. It's that time of year. Thank you, Danny. So, you know, just another day, just another dead kid, another dead daddy, but we have real freedom here in America because we got the goons. Oh, Lord, if them little weirdos at the NRA and Gun Owners of America goobers, if they could hear all, they'd fill their britches. Fill your britches, you sons of bitches. Oh, wait, that's not the line from True Grit. No. You wanna know why little 12-year-old boys wind up dying in a hail of incendiary gunfire? And why little 3.5-year-old boys wind up dying because the lawful gun owner left his concealed carry weapon on the floor of a freaking closet? I'll tell you why. No, better yet, I'll let Brian Fisher.
I think that we may be headed toward bloodshed in America, and the avenues to get to that place, as distressing as that is, there are a number of avenues starting right where we're at right now that could lead to bloodshed, could lead to anarchy, could lead to chaos.
Brian, this is over on the American Family Association radio. You know, he's so matter of fact and so businesslike. We may be on the way to bloodshed. We may be on the way to revolution. We may be on the way to anarchy. Go to Henderson County, Tennessee, Brian Fisher, you turd. Tell me what we're on the way to. Go to Dundee, Michigan, Brian Fisher. You misanthropic pile of pus. And tell me what we're on the way to. You know, with any of these people, in any of these horrible circumstances, seldom can you prove point A to point B, that one thing led to another. But there is such a thing as the general creation of a social cultural climate. God, wasn't there a gun store sign 5 or 6 years ago that said, Obama is coming, buy your ammo now? So there could be. It's not like there already is in Brian Fisher's world. There could be bloodshed.
I think that we may be headed toward bloodshed in America, and the avenues to get to that place, as distressing as that is, there are a number of avenues starting right where we're at right now that could lead to bloodshed, could lead to anarchy, could lead to chaos in America. And I don't want to see that. You don't want to see that. Nobody wants to see that. We don't want to see us turn into Egypt or even a low-calorie version of Egypt. We don't want that. We don't want bloodshed. We don't want violence. We want peace. We want stability. We're taught in the Scriptures to pray for that, that we may live peaceful and tranquil lives in all godliness. That's what we're instructed to pray for. And that's why we want to pray for that, and that's why we want to work now, George. That's why I think that's why it's disappointing to me that we don't have lawmakers that are willing to face their constituents, because that's what we're trying to prevent. You know, we want to bring about cultural change through the ballot box, not through bullets. That's our mechanism of change, ballots and not bullets. But if our elected officials will not listen to us, if they will not meet with us, if they will not respond to the urgent appeal of their own constituents, the people that elected them to office, then eventually you might get to the point, George, where what you're talking about could happen. People will just get fed up, and then you'll start having some very, very unpredictable things that will happen, and we do not want to get there.
Thanks to our dear friends at rightwingwatch.org for the manifest fortitude that it must certainly require to listen to that hate-filled drivel day in and day out. I think we may be headed toward bloodshed in America. But he doesn't want that. He doesn't want that. He's perfectly content with an America where 3.5-year-old children blow their brains out, 22-year-old Australian baseball players are gunned down for sport, and 48-year-old Tennessee daddies start ammo dump explosions that take out their 12-year-old sons. Brian Fisher is okay with that. But by God, if these elected representatives don't start having town hall meetings, we could get to the point where people will just get fed up, and then you'll start having some very, very unpredictable things that'll happen. Oh, for F's sake. So there's the filibobster for this evening. 14 minutes past the hour, 7:14 here in the Eastern Time Zone. Feel free to add your... the conversation becomes value-added when you participate in it. So jump right in. We'll take a break and come back. This is Conversation Radio. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn. Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Revolution rock. It is a brand new rock. A five rock. This here revolution rock. Be careful how you move back. You dig me in the back. And I'm so peeled up that I rap out. I have got the sharpest knife, so I got the biggest fight. I got no time to do battle. Hey, everybody flash up your seats and rock to this brand new beat. This is your music mash up the nation. This is your music cause a sensation. Tell your mom, tell your bar, everything gonna be alright. Can't you feel it? Don't ignore it. It's gonna be alright. Up your seat and rock to this brand new beat.
Dr. John says, excellent choice. The Clash from London Calling. Revolution Rock. I saw that. I remember that line in the song. Young people shoot their days away. That's how that choice got made. Thanks, Dr. John. Danny writing in. I'm with you on everything you're saying today, Bob. And your hick gun freedom-loving voice is the highlight of my day. Oh my God. Yes, that makes my life kind of pathetic, or you're that amusing. We're going, not for my own ego's sake, Danny. We're going to vote for amusing because I can't imagine your life is pathetic. Brian Fisher can kiss my ass, Danny says, after I wipe it with friable asbestos. Don't do that to your... No. I don't believe in capital punishment, but do believe in culling the herd of those with double-digit IQs or those believing in Bronze Age juvenile gods. Hear, hear. Hear, hear. Jeremy, with a note coming in via Skype. Between last night's program and tonight, especially last night, I've chewed through 3 tennis balls and used 5 rolls of duct tape. And yes, go Bob, go. And the angry Indian says, anything by The Clash is brilliant. And I have to concur as well. With regard to Terry York of Henderson County, Tennessee, Marty asking, Darwin Award nomination for this guy? No, I don't think so. I don't think so, Marty, because, well, frankly, the Darwin Award is generally awarded to people who will not reproduce and send their genetics on down the line. Terry York reproduced and then took out his own progeny, you know, because he couldn't have enough ammunition. You're gonna need a lot of ammunition when the government comes. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Oh Lord God. If you're on hold, well, no. Let's go to the phones. I'll go straight to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
And good evening. How are you, sir?
What's happening, Jim?
Well, I've been listening to you and looking at TV at the same time, you know, trying to walk and chew gum.
That can get a little confusing.
Oh, I know it can. But I agree with a lot of what you said about this gun business and this thing with these three boys shooting that runner down. That really is just dreadful.
Well, it gets past the point of... is there... And I hesitate to... See, I'm stuttering. I hesitate to even ask this, because we've already been through Virginia Tech and Columbine and Newtown and Aurora and I'm already out of fingers and I got to take my shoes off and start on my toes and you don't want to know what happens when we get to 21. Is there anything in this country that can happen that can make us finally say enough?
I don't know, Bob. I don't know. I emailed you several times, but you never read it. Nothing surprises me anymore. And when I saw the story about that young man who was out there jogging, training for baseball, and these three idiots, or I would use another term, but I'm not going to, in polite company.
Well, no, vicious killers. I think we can use that in polite company.
You know, I don't know what I can categorize people like that, but they'd best be glad that I wouldn't be on that jury. But they just shot that boy in the back, and he fell to his knees. And then expired.
And I mean, there is some follow up available that never gets done. You know, we didn't even really get a hell of a lot of follow up on Adam Lanza. You know, when he shot Mother Lanza and then went and did the elementary school. There's never any. You got a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old, and a 17-year-old in some part of Oklahoma. And they decided it would be fun to go and kill somebody. And they even posted it on Facebook, for God's sakes.
Bob, there's nothing fun about killing anybody.
You get no argument from me about that, Jim. I mean,
we've talked about this before, and I can assure you that anybody who thinks that's fun, that's somebody that I just could never understand or welcome into my company. Either mentally or physically.
But I mean, can we ask? And I'm not asking this rhetorically. I'm asking this really. In America, absolutely gun insane America, can we ask questions about these three? Because the only thing that'll be proffered out there by the NRA or Gun Owners of America or gun goobers for freedom or whatever they call themselves is that, well, obviously they were mentally ill.
Oh, I don't think so. They knew right from wrong.
Can we ask questions about a benighted culture that never notices that kids like this might have a problem?
Obviously, it's escaping the people who should detect it, and I can give you a number of reasons for that, which we could talk about 9 o'clock.
But Jim, let me ask you this. You said and this is kind of a thought experiment. Who are the people that should detect this stuff?
I don't know. Their parents would be one, I would think. They brought them into the world. They reared them or raised them, whichever you want to say. And then, of course, you've got, I don't know, maybe professional school counselors or people like that. But I just think that...
Ministers...
I don't know about ministers, anybody who...
Sunday school...
Anybody who would be in a position to act as a mentor or...
How about a cop on the beat, even assuming that... even if this is some small-town Oklahoma, which in many ways is like small-town anywhere else, you know, you've usually got a cop, and if you go, you know, hey, officer, come here. What are the kids like around here? Usually the statement comes out, well, you know, you got your good ones, you got your bad ones, and then you got your really awful ones. And you know, there's just a few of them, and they're always a problem. Anytime something goes wrong around here, you know who to go looking for.
Yeah, I pray you're right. Pray you're right. I don't know. When I saw the young man's family in Australia and how they were so grief-stricken by it, it was just... And I saw the picture of the young man and the tribute that was given to him by his girlfriend or whatever, that he was always living in her heart. It was certainly very touching.
But I mean, if
there's not a whole lot I can say about it, to tell you the truth, other than I'm just deeply saddened and horrified. You know, that's all I can add.
Well, I'm just thinking about what Robert said. We're shocked and we don't know what to think, and we're horrified.
And then tomorrow it'll bring something else. But, you know, on a brighter note, I just want to read something to you that came to mind when I was watching television, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
And it's a tribute to Hattie McDaniels.
Okay.
And it's as far-fetched from gun complaint and stuff like that, but it meant a lot to me when I saw it. And I said, Dear Bob, even though today is not our birthday, TCM has been running a series of films starring the wonderful and endearing Miss Hattie McDaniels, who in her many roles as a domestic and character actress played Thane with such aplomb and talent, often outshone and exceeded contemporary actors in so many films. She paved the way for so many African-American stars who followed her. If I had my way, there would be a Miss Hattie McDaniels today, and a star would shine tonight bearing her name. May she never be forgotten, and will always live in my heart with fond memories.
Well said. And a brilliant actress indeed. And had to fight all the way uphill.
Yes, she did.
But, you know, one of the things that shines through about, of course, the performance that people know her more for than any other, you know, Mammy in Gone with the Wind, and God, even using that name, I mean, just so many stereotypes. She displayed more dignity in that film
than any other
human being in it.
Well, I was fixing to say that. And that's going to be on at 8 o'clock tonight, by the way. I'm sure you're not going to watch it, but, you know, there it is. I mean, she certainly did. And, you know, a lot of people have forgotten about her, don't know who she is, don't know who she was, and she lived so long ago. And, you know, but I don't forget people. And I don't forget the impression they make upon me. And being from the South and South Carolina, I certainly understand.
Well, we lost another titan of the inquiry into American culture has died. Albert Murray was 97 years old. He died at his home in Harlem. He was a contemporary. One of his best friends was Ralph Ellison.
Oh, okay.
Wrote magnificent books. One of the first ones to, or one of, in the middle of the Black Separatist movement, he wrote, created a term called the Omni-Americans that said that Black culture is inseparable from American culture. I think he was the first one to reject both Black and African American as monikers. He said, "I'm not an African, I'm an American."
No, I understand. Well, I mean, when you look at things like the Harlem Renaissance and Langston Hughes and so many others who were his contemporaries, and just all of the arts and you know.
Well, and it's that specific reference to the arts, Jim, that is most telling out of Mr. Murray's life, because he coined the term blues aesthetic. And he said that the blues aesthetic permeates the works of Black musicians, writers, and artists. The New York Times obit of him says it was and noted that it was being increasingly adopted by whites, which is the truth about whether it's blues or jazz or rock and roll, hip-hop, fashion trends.
On and on and on. We wouldn't have much without them. I mean, you can start with Lil Green, Lil Johnson, and we've talked about them and those body girls and how wonderful they are. And you can go all the way through Dorothy Dandridge. You can go all the way through. Oh, I can't name them. You know who they are.
And by the way, since you referenced Hattie McDaniel, the angry Indian, pointing out something to me via the Skype chat, he says in private life, Hattie McDaniel supported the more active wing of the Black Liberation Movement. Step and Fetch It did the same thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And became a member of the Nation of Islam later in life. Step and Fetch It was with Muhammad Ali when he dropped the mob's homie for the heavyweight crown.
I'll be damned. Well, I thank the angry Indian for that information. But I just thought, having seen her in three films this afternoon, and just saying how wonderful she played those roles and how she managed to climb that Hollywood ladder back in those days. I mean, it is to her credit. And like I say, if I had my way, there would be a Hattie McDaniels Day, there would be a Pearl Bailey Day, and there would be a whole constellation of stars that would bear their names.
Well, Jim, that's very well said. Knowing your love of books, I highly, if you've never read it, I strongly suggest you get your hands on some Albert Murray books. This is what he wrote about the blues. This is beautiful, and if Bill is listening, he'll hoop and holler when he hears this. He said, Albert Murray wrote, "When the Negro musician or dancer swings the blues, he is fulfilling the same fundamental existential requirement that determines the mission of the poet, the priest, and the medicine man. He is making an affirmative and hence exemplary and heroic response to that which André Malraux describes as la condition humaine."
Well said, well written. That's an incredible book. What's the name of this book again?
Well, that's from one of his essays. Omni Americans was the book of essays. His one of his most brilliant memoir/novels is called Train Whistle Guitar.
Okay.
And he writes about his upbringing in Mobile, Alabama.
I can imagine that would be very interesting to read. Like I say, we have a whole constellation of stars like this who oftentimes are forgotten, be they, you know, whoever they are, from James Baldwin all the way through, you name it, and also in the modern cinema today. And that's about all I have to say, because I know you got other callers.
All right, Jim, thank you very much. Enjoy the movie.
And have a good show.
All right, you take care.
Bye
now. Note coming in via Skype from Isaac. He says, Gone with the Wind, a movie about a woman who falls in love with the man who raped her. Southern, what was the name of that wonderful, wonderful band of years back? Southern Culture on the Skids. Yeah, let's keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. How you doing?
Hey, John, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. I'm on the porch drinking some watermelon wine I made back in the summer of 2010, and it's...
How did it age?
extraordinarily well.
Beautiful. You know, while it was kind of mind-blowing while I was in D.C., and it was so, so hot. One of the little local restaurants nearby was featuring on its daily specials menu a watermelon gazpacho.
Oh,
if you can fathom it.
Wow.
And I can't walk away from something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I try my server said, you know, we can't get anybody to try it. And I said, bring me a bowl. And it was magnificent, you know, because you don't think about things like cilantro running up against watermelon and good things happening, but it did. And it had little tiny microscopic crumbles of blue cheese in it even.
Ooh, man.
Yeah.
I can see that really working. Some people I know like to salt their watermelon.
Oh, God, yes. My father would empty about a half a box of Morton's on his.
Yeah, my dad. I think maybe it goes back to the old days when they would, put watermelon in salt and with some ice, and some salt on it to melt the ice, you know, and
yeah,
like that. But so I could see that working really well. I'm surprised in D.C. they had trouble move in that. I would think there's some adventurous food types there.
And, you know, Jim the other night said D.C. is a gastronomic wonderland, and he wasn't kidding. I mean, there's a little bit of everything there. But, no, they couldn't. And so I made sure that I sent compliments back to Chef in the kitchen saying that he had done a good thing, or she.
Wow. Well, good on you. That sounds splendid, actually. I gotta look at something like that. Listen, I wanted to, I was catching up with last night's, program today, and I was really, really struck by, that Fungi with a TV show who tried to go onto a college campus and get people to hate on the transsexuals.
Yeah, at George Mason University in Virginia, right.
Yeah, even there, I could have told him he'd be barking up the wrong tree. Kids today, I guess I already sound like an old man, but kids today, that's a game they just don't play. There is absolutely no interest in shaming people because of sexuality, sexual expression, from what I've seen.
It's even borne out in what was her name, Stephanie Patelos, down in Alabama. Granted, she agreed to shut her trap in order to keep her position, but you know the you can't unring a bell, as the saying goes. And she said something that the diehard stalwart, you know, tired old pasty faced doughy white people in Alabama of the GOP desperately needed to hear. This is not a winning strategy for growing the party.
Yeah. No, it's not. I mean, they need to spend some time on Tumblr or sit in, you know, at a commons at a college or something, because that's a non-starter for kids these days. I mean, there's obviously troubled young people who have issues with this, and we see this in crime and things like that. But by and large, I mean, that is just not a that's not something kids today have any interest in.
Well, and you know, there are reasons beyond the simple enlightenment of one, you know, we've got this myth in the United States that the goal is for each generation to provide a better life for the generation that's coming next.
Yeah.
And while monetarily this may be, it is said that this is the first generation that won't do that, John, we maybe have done it in more important ways. Because the door, you know, it goes back to the 60s. It goes back to the heroes of the early 70s and Stonewall, and it is a legacy of increased tolerance.
Yeah,
and maybe that's more important than monetary increase. Is that possible?
Well, when you have monetary troubles, your ideals also often start to take a beating, just from necessity, you know. But no, I mean, there is we are lurching in fits and starts towards increasing tolerance of diversity, partly because we have to be, and people who are coming up nowadays, I think, have been surrounded by this their entire lives, and it's not that they refuse to see anything wrong with it. It that signal doesn't transmit. They don't pick up on it. They're like, why are you telling me that I should be you know, dismissive or hostile towards transgender people? I know them. You know, that's the attitude today. So it's goofy. And I thought you handled the your commentary on that guy was just spot on. My blood was boiling when he pretended to be transgender and took on that voice and that little lisp and that the way he described it was just disgusting. And the woman he was talking to, you could tell, was very nonplussed by what he was saying.
Yeah. Because, you know, all gay people speak that way.
Right. It's absurd.
Well, the idea that he was billed, and you know I'm going here, the idea that he billed himself as a journalist just made me scream, and it kind of echoed down into what Dr. Bill was doing this afternoon when he was talking about the fact that modern, say, you know, your college freshmen, your sophomores and stuff, if asked, and this goes back to a paper that he found and sent to me, from a professor who was despairing of attempting to teach his young students, because he would say to them, I want you to write an argument in favor of or against, you know, topic fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And he got an email from a student who said, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. I reject that. the problem in this culture is there is too much arguing. And so we have, you know, we've created a culture where if we're not screaming at each other, I mean, the whole idea of persuasion, persuasive communication, is pretty much dead.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think you see that in some of that thing last night where the guy, I mean, it was an epic fail. He couldn't get these young people to do anything except saying, well, I think my parents would probably freak out.
Yeah. Even at Mason, it was a non-starter.
Right. And George Mason, for those who don't know, like I said repeatedly, is among the most conservative universities in the state of Virginia, which is not known as being a bastion of liberal thought.
Yeah. You know, I think that part of the problem with having trouble with persuasive arguments and that sort, or persuasive, you know, conversations or building arguments, that sort of thing, is that there's very much a sense out there, a real sort of postmodern idea that every point is equally valid, and it's not a general sort of skepticism towards authority, and that, you know, saying that I can make this argument to you, and I have this huge wealth of knowledge, and I'm going to present it to you, and here's the reason that I think this, and that's a problem for a lot of people, because we're trained to believe, to accept that all opinions are equally valid, and that is certainly not true, but it's a very pervasive idea in our culture right now. We distrust authority, which in degrees is good, but we also, the corollary of that is we give equal credence, equal weight to anyone's opinion, and that's a real problem, and I think Dr. Bill talked a bit about that yesterday.
Well, and I wonder, I mean, is this because if you look historically, most of how to make an argument reaches its full flower with Cicero, with whom I have a lot of problems. But Cicero becomes the model for rhetoric and persuasive argument for, 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Does this constitute a shift away from that?
Well, I think it's been building. I mean, everything, you know, all over the internet, right? Everything is commentary. You know, it seems like there's so little attempt to persuade or convince or present new information. You know, the height of creativity online is to take a picture of a cat and put a funny caption on it. It's all derivative. You know, it's not new and interesting and thoughtful and creative. And I think it's a postmodern thing, really. You know, everything is equally valid. I tell my students, you know, I have 4 degrees. You know, you might have read an article on Wikipedia once, but I have a certain level of authority in what I say because I've been thinking about this stuff for years, and I've been theorizing about it and writing about it and studying it, et cetera, et cetera. So despite what you're told, that everyone's opinion is equally valid, it's not really the case. You know, and that's a hard sell in some ways, I think.
Well, is that because the concept of having to make one's bones has become foreign, or is it militate against some, and I apologize for using the term, libertarian egalitarian streak?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Yeah, these libertarian ideas they run the currents, they run deep in a lot of things in the culture today, and it's real distressing.
Well, I mean, here, John, even with the horn and the conversations that we have, I try to be really, really, I wouldn't say meticulous because I don't say it often enough to qualify as such, but I don't hold myself out as a journalist.
Yeah.
I have been one. I know how to do it, especially in the radio format, but does anybody think that if you're leaning over the fence with your over the back fence with your neighbor while the wind blows the clothes dry, that you're both going to sit there and swap objective observations of reality with one another? Because I don't think that's the nature of the human condition.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
And as such, Well, I saw an article on Salon today, and I was about, you know, I was just a few seconds from sending it on to you, but I know how busy you are. But it was a sort of a comparison between, and I don't want to get into too much of the substance of it, between the Time magazine writer Grunewald and the Guardian writer Greenwald. Mm-hmm. And over the weekend, Grunewald got himself in a whole bunch of hot fat because of a really, and pardon me for the coarseness of my dialogue, dickish thing that he said, which was, I can't wait to write a defense of the drone strike that takes out Julian Assange.
Yeah, I saw that.
And that's just shocking. I mean, there's no way, whatever ideological difference I may have, and I think I announced them a couple of nights ago, last best hope of democracy in the United States is the right wing of the Republican Party. Wow.
Yeah.
Whatever philosophical differences I may have, I'm not going to get on board with somebody saying that a person should be hell fired for having that opinion.
No, of course not.
But the Salon article had to do with the fact, or the query as to who now is a journalist. In an era where everybody injects opinion into everything, because that's one of the knocks on Grunewald is that instead of reporting his thoughts on the national security state or whatever, he has never been a reporter. He has always been an opinion writer. And you can tell me right now, if you are strictly in the opinion business, are you a journalist per se, or does one need to be working a beat and doing the the five facts stuff? I don't have any answers anymore, John.
Yeah.
No, go ahead, please.
I've always had an issue, even when I was a receptive little journalism student, to the idea that there could be no we have to divorce opinions and life experience from how we report. It seemed very artificial to me at all times. That's how it works in the U.S. It's not necessarily how it works everywhere. I don't think that fake objectivity, which doesn't exist, is a requirement for journalism. I don't think.
So we can say that Grunewald is a journalist, and Grunewald is a journalist.
Yeah.
But there's a line that one crosses when one suggests that it'll be some great getting up morning when the Hellfire missile flies over and blows Julian Assange into a million pieces. I mean, I was really. I mean, that's Limbaugh-esque, and the guys writing at Time Magazine. Are there any? I guess the question: are there any standards left at all?
Yeah, I mean, you can be a journalist and still be a dick, I suppose, is the answer, and then that's too kind, I think, and still be a misanthrope, I suppose, a horrible person. But yeah, it's not the problem isn't journalism per se. The problem is for profit journalism, and we've been talking about this forever. You know, that's a great thing to say for them because look at all the people that clicked on Time magazine and read the story and retweeted it. That's perfect for Time. They don't care.
Sure, what's the link bait?
Yeah, exactly, and that's in a market driven business like that. That's the truth, or what is good for humanity, or what is good for your community, takes a backseat to getting eyeballs on pages and money in the ledgers, you know.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm kind of at sea where all of this is concerned, John, because I think Dr. Bill presented a valid critique and a valid concern. We all know what concern trolling looks like. That's not what Dr. Bill was doing.
Yeah.
But the question of how we go forward, because these are, as Dr. Bill said in the second hour this afternoon, he said that, you know, these are essential questions of epistemology. And he related the story. He was talking with his wife earlier today, and she said, what are you going to talk about? And he said, I think I'm going to talk a little bit about epistemology. And she said, really? How many listeners do you plan to lose with that one? Or something along those lines, and he said, "I guess we'll find out." But you know, the question of how we know what we know and the means of information acquisition, I think is an especially astute one at this point in time, because everything seems to be in transition. Everything's in a state of flux.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
Yeah, and I need to go back. I haven't heard today's program yet, so I need to go back and listen to that. I love good questions of epistemology. I life experience is part of it. It's a big part of it. Of course, we all see things differently, but there's an objective reality out there, and there are definable motivations that people act under. Part of it is from our heritage as a species that is. Not so long ago, we're living in trees, and part of it is the natural conflict that comes up when people form groups and interests begin to form. And so when I try to think about what motivates people to behave the way they do, and hence how I know what I know and what I think I know and what is real and what is not real and what is important and what's not, that's what I think about. I said before, I look to Darwin and I look to Marx, because that's my understanding based on my experience, my study of humanity, such as it is.
And they tend to answer questions better than Hobbes, Locke, Smith.
Yeah, I think so. They have a slightly different approach in some ways, but I think what's most important about understanding us and therefore the nature of our reality is our heritage as animals with culture. And our natural ability to form groups that are composed of people with conflicting interests.
And yet, you referenced, John, the concept of conflict. If you don't mind me making you time travel just a little bit, you sent an article along a month or so ago that I read with absolute fascination. When you say we form groups and the groups then have conflicts, it does not necessarily, however, going back to the reference of using Hellfire missiles, it does not necessarily stand to reason, however, that through the long history, well, relatively short perhaps, but long to us, history of human endeavor and human existence, it doesn't necessarily mean that just because there's conflict, there's going to be warfare and bloodshed. And that sort of takes me back to the whole Brian Fisher thing.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain a little bit about that, if you can recall it, just off the top of your very busy mind? Where the idea of conflict enters into the human experience, or warfare and bloodshed and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I remember the article. I was trying to think what the article was. I remember what it was now. Right, the study about warfare in non-Western societies and where it comes from and who does it. There's always conflict, even in the most egalitarian of all cultures that we can study. Living people today, like the San and the Kalahari, right. No organized warfare, no real intergroup violence, but there is always conflict based on really basic things about the way we are as humans, age and gender. Those are the two basic differences. No matter how equal your society is, there's men and women, or maybe a third gender, and there's old people and young people, and that creates conflict. So there's always friction in any society, no matter how equal you are. If you share everything, perfect communism in the general sense.
Yeah.
There's always people with more power, with more strength, with more power, with more knowledge, with more wisdom. That happens. So there's always conflict. Humans never live in perfect peace with each other. But we don't see in living cultures we study, in groups of people we study archaeologically, we don't see organized mass killing between different groups of people until there's a struggle over resources. And that's the basic thing. Once there is a decision made that this is mine, this is ours, and that is yours, then friction develops between groups. And between group conflict is the nasty conflict. That's when people start being killed just because of who they are. And so there was what you referenced in this article, there was a big study, a big question in social sciences, are humans, inherently, by nature, violent, or is violence something that society puts on us, warfare? And by studying cross-culturally, reports of ethnographers out in the field, people who go and live with non-Western cultures for years at a time and study them and learn what they do and why they do it and what they think, the general conclusion by this recent research is that no, it's not an inherent thing. Violence between groups comes about because of conflicts over resources. So that's kind of a long way of maybe answering. Is that what you were after?
That's precisely what I was after. Because if I recall the conclusions correctly, the counter argument is that humans have always been violent. Humans have always been warlike. You know, we've always been at war with East Asia, Orwell. Ain't necessarily the case.
Well, no, it's not. There's no point in conquering another group's territory and slaughtering the men, women, and children down to the last animal. If you don't have a concept in your society of property ownership, you know? If there's no sense that this grove of mangoes is ours and that is yours, and we're going to come take yours when ours go away, there's no point in conquest. In large-scale violence.
So when there is a justification, let's say, you know, our deity told us to take your land, that can almost routinely be dismissed as being subterfuge or a cover for some deeper level of I want what you've got.
Right. You don't have deities telling you to go. Destroy the other tribe until the other tribe has something that you want. It's a funny little dodge that way, you know.
Yeah.
God wants us to take your land, but that assumes that we have a concept of your land and our land, which is certainly not historically the case.
Well, that's because there can't be in a hunter-gatherer society. It's hard to formulate that concept of my land and your land when everybody's just sort of wandering, right?
Yeah, and their populations are small and they're sustainable. And when the population gets too big to be sustainable, they don't plant themselves in one place and start farming. People die. So there's all kinds of methods in place to make sure that the population doesn't get too big and it stays in balance with the ecosystem, you know?
That's fascinating, John. It seems like we spend an inordinate amount of time. I don't mean you or me or the Horn Family Commune. I mean, we as a species spend an inordinate amount of time trying to figure out ways not to learn that.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Yeah, because we're taught that the way you win is to have the most stuff when you die. And that's a very, very recent conclusion we've come to.
Yeah, it's the last 6,000-7,000 years, right?
Yeah, exactly. We talked the other night about Neanderthals and how they get kind of a bad rap. They certainly would look at that idea and think that, wow, who are these unevolved jerks? And I'm sure glad we're not in their gene pool. Right? So anyway. This was a lot of fun, Bob. I'm going to get out of the way and let some other folks talk.
Well, I appreciate it, John. I really, really do. Thank you very kindly because, I've actually got an email here I'm going to share in a minute. That back references your explanation of the difference between agency and performance.
Oh, cool. Great.
All right.
Well, I'll listen then.
All right. Take care, John. Bye. Our buddy Dr. John, and lines are open, 304-658-3333. Going right back to the phones in just about a half a tick. But the note that I'm referencing comes from Chris in California, who says, as we at the Horn grapple daily, and this goes back to the transgender hissy fit that the right wing are presently having, as we at the Horn grapple daily to gain some kind of working understanding of the worldview of these right wing lunatics, I feel like the recent reaction to the California gender identity bill for schools has revealed a telling bit of information about their psyches, which I also have been suspecting for a while now. It has to do with their attitude toward categorization. We on this mental side of the chasm at one point realized two things. First, many categories are arbitrary, which is to say things like gender solely are defined by situational or cultural factors and not by some sort of platonic perfect man, perfect woman. Dr. John put this much more clearly in an earlier missive, basically pointing out that the gender identities we arrive at are more often what is offered up by our own culture than determined by insightful soul-searching and a, quote-unquote, choice. Considering that one cannot choose to be born intelligent or beautiful or pick one's hair color or shoe size, the idea that sexual orientation or gender identity is inconsistent with this flies in the face of common sense. Oh, wait. Religion. The second thing we managed to come to grips with is that categorization itself is a habit of mind in and of itself, which evolutionarily is extremely handy. We can sort experiences in ways where they can be dealt with in the proper way. Categorization is how we actually go about making sense of things. Useful, yes, but human beings also have an established mental habit of wedging new problems into old categories. And religion is the worst example of this. Just as bad is the fact that Western civilization is locked into a death embrace with capitalism, and we look for capitalist solutions to problems where capitalism is anathema to the solution. My overall summary of these two points is that you and I are aware, and by extension, Chris means us, are aware that there are unknown categories. We know that we don't know much, and hence when someone comes along and says, "I feel like a man, but look like a woman," we just make room for a new category. We understand the mutable nature of categories and our own understanding. As a result, we are prepared to learn new things. Right-wingers are not. The categories they have in life were not reached through careful observation and skepticism, but rather received wisdom. God says there are men and women, and that's it. There's no room for new categories in their brain because the categories that they already know are the only right ones. If anything tries to make inroads as a new category, it is so alarming to their static worldview that they react with fear and loathing when confronted with reality. Any departure from the world they know and have defined is necessarily bad because, oh, so much of the time, this is all wrapped up in white privilege. They take for granted everything about their lives, and anything that causes them to sacrifice is oppression of their privilege. Until they realize their own privilege, it is impossible for them to realize how its mere existence, as you have said, poisons their worldview and blinds them to the suffering of others. Hope you don't mind a bit of rambling speculation. Didn't mind in the least. I love this kind of stuff. That's what conversation is about. I feel like coming to a true understanding of a right-wing mind is like the search for the Holy Grail. Incredibly tantalizing and always just out of reach. Happy Titanic Tuesday to you, Bob, and the Horn family. Thank you all for keeping this groundbreaking program on the air. You are all my heroes. Much love. Signed, Chris. Wow. I love things like this because 9 times out of 10, y'all say things more eloquently and more sanely and more cogently than anything that comes out of my mouth in the midst of any one of a number of the hissies that I have on air with an open microphone on any given night. But maybe we have to start with the hissy and work our way toward calm, cool, and collected. That's what I tell myself in the dark and still of the night when I'm listening to the day's show again and sort of self-critiquing, as I almost always do. You wouldn't want to be here. I'm generally over in a corner, pulled up into a fetal ball and sucking my thumb. It's terrifying. By the way, we stand this evening. We stand at 8:05 at about $95 to go to meet tonight's challenge by Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. It is rather important at this point in time that we keep up with fundraising because, you know, don't need to go into big details, but this whole affair can disappear pretty damn quick. And so getting out of holes and staying out of holes becomes rather of a critical importance. And I say all this because, like I said, I'm going to be on the road a bunch of September. And so that means, I mean, the hole is going to be really deep. Wish it wasn't, but it will be. so it goes. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. Snail mail address. Traditional mail address is too. And thank you. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Well, you guys got me going tonight. You and, what's his name? Why do I care? Me and names anymore. Don't ask me what mine is at the wrong time of day, you know?
Just don't call you late for something.
Your fellow Virginian.
Oh, West Virginian.
West Virginian.
Yes. We get right tetchy about that, Bill.
I don't blame you.
You talk about Jim there? And the conversation we had about? Yeah.
Because he's right. If I'm not mistaken, didn't that lady you were speaking of, was she on radio at all?
Oh, I'm certain she was. Hattie McDaniel?
Yeah, I think she might have done the sitcom work for a while. And it could have been her, and it could have been a couple other women who did the Bueller job, you know. Because an acting job is an acting job, you know. and if you're good, you can cover every base there is, from some of the most serious to basically comedic stuff.
Yeah, blackface.
And people worked at what they could get. I mean, I was listening to what's his name, the political Jesse Jackson. He was talking about seeing the old earliest Amos and Andy stuff, which I saw, you know, the original with the black cast. And those guys were good comics. The guys who played the comic leads, they knew what the hell they were doing, the same way Red Fox, when he had a show on TV, he mixed up the comedians. The white cop was as funny as, you know,
he
could be in his own way. And everybody, the neighbor, who later appeared with the Barney Miller, the Hispanic actor.
Right.
And what I learned about from... My dad left me with two books on vaudeville. And, man, the Theater Owners Booking Association. You ever hear of them?
No.
They were a bunch who did a lot of booking of black, whatever, African-American. I don't know what, you know, everybody... it's not my place to pick a term for anybody, you know. The standard line from the artists who worked for these people was TOBA stood for Tough on Black Artists. Because let's face it, these guys were typical.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't have chuckled.
No, this is fine. Because it's true. I mean, this is something that was attributed to people who worked in that circuit. And they're absolutely right, because these guys, these booking agents, were tough on everybody. And if they thought they could push it a little, they would. I mean, I worked for guys that were, I don't know whether they were booking a band or trying to sell me a used car. You know, it was just part of the
Probably business. Depended on which way the transaction trended.
Yeah, where was the money going? But the whole idea of... Oh, I was living in a projects which... We're built in, they opened in 39, they were on East 30th Street, down by where Tri-C is now in Cleveland, with a, you know, the junior college, the main campus. And they tore out the whole neighborhood and put in these brick apartments, three-story and blah, blah. But your neighbors were from every place around the world, you know. Hell, we had a few families come in from Hungary after that 56 revolution. So you name it, you'd meet somebody from there. And in fact, one guy I used to do some babysitting for, and he liked me. He'd hang out with me, and we would. We were members of the Grape Drinkers Society, and I won't say what we drank, but I'll just say what's the word. And anybody of a certain age will know exactly what we were drinking.
Yes.
And this guy was a Korean vet. And there was a guy who had a darker tan than all of us. He was a Korean vet, and they were real good with me. They let me take a taste of the stuff on the fifth round. You know, I mean, I was 15 years old, and that's one thing, Bob. I never had a problem with booze. I never kept booze in the house. Well, I could drink like a fish if I was playing it, if I felt like it. But it wasn't something that I demanded every day of my life, thank God. And tobacco is what's going to kill me. Jesus, you know, in my generation, if you weren't smoking when you were 15, you must not like Humphrey Bogart, you know, too much. Because that was just a fact of life then.
Yeah.
But so many of the things that, you know, you're talking about with the movie actors, and I was lucky that it didn't mean anything to me because, you know, my neighbors were some of them looked that way. And they were, as, like everybody else, struggling to try to, you know, stay one step ahead of the hunger man. We didn't have to worry too much about that was one of the better things that Roosevelt did. He opened three of those places, one down by the lake, and that was mostly people who supposedly preferred potatoes. And the rest were whatever, you know. It was, and Rick, I think, would tell you very much the same thing, that in many ways, places like that were great to grow up. Because you got to look at everybody up close, and, you know, you didn't have this, I mean, this god-awful fear that people have. Now, today, and as I say, I just finished Grapes of Wrath a couple nights ago, a repeat of that that I hadn't read since I was a kid. And I'm afraid we're going back that way. I'm afraid we're heading back in that direction faster than we can put the brakes on it.
If there are any brakes left, Bill.
Yeah, if there's anything we can do. Yeah, you know, I got one. I just, one of my buddies who's a school teacher, he taught history in Lake County systems. In fact, he taught the kids that belong to the guy that just retired from the House of Representatives out there. He has a very French-sounding last name. You know, Latourette.
Yes.
My buddy taught his kids, and he said he knew the guy pretty well, and of course talked to him when it was, you know, student teacher nights and, or family teacher nights. And yeah, my buddy, he's a strong left. I keep trying to get him to listen to you, but he sometimes you'll see stuff that I sent with a certain name on it that's kind of German sounding, and. He's kept, you know, we met in a bar, and when we're finished talking on a break, he says, hey, by the way, where did you go to college? The old Knox College deal, you know, our Knox.
Yeah.
I wish I had, Bob, but
at this point in time, Bill, I'm prepared to say that you did pretty well without it.
Well, I took some electronics courses to back up, the basic TV course that I took. I got a few of them. And when I started going in there and I'm talking to some of these professors, and I said, have you ever worked in the field? Well, no. And I just kind of shake my head and walk away at that point. And because theory is one thing. Practice is something else all the time, you know. It's just the way it is. And I just caught another book that I had here and disappeared. Was a written by a guy named with the unlikely name of Fletcher Pratt, Short History of the Civil War. What a piece of work. This was published in the 30s. And, man, this when I read that, all of a sudden, all the pro-rebellion stuff that was in me as a kid just fell off. And I said, wait a minute, you know? Because this guy wrote about things like Krakatoa. And what the hell is Krakatoa? You know, it was a big volcano in the Pacific, was it not?
Yeah.
I looked it up.
Really big.
Yes, really big one. And, man, I had this book. And what I do is if I get enough of this stuff and I go to the site center here, they have volunteer readers. And, you know, you can get something. Because they don't put everything that is put out is not on audio. And I wish it was. Because, man, I mean, what else is there to do?
Well, see, Bill, I was going to mention this the other night when we were talking about you needing audiobooks. There's a service out there now called Audible.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the company, Audible.
And it is, it's a classic example of something Dr. John was talking about some nights back, and that is the elitism of the Internet.
Yeah, it is.
You can have as much Audible content, and this is like the old books on tape in a way, I guess, only it's a digital file format. And, you know, let's say you're driving down the road and you pop the book in instead of
yeah
right
you mean instead of listening to some fat slob. Never mind.
Blast
I don't want to rush into that.
No, I'll take the guy on the harp any day.
Well, I know what you mean. Yes.
But the problem is that I've seen the pitches for it on Amazon, for instance. Basically, the old "Hey kid, the first one's free."
Yeah.
You know, sign up for Audible and your first book is free.
Yeah.
And then when you start going around looking for books, you find out that these things are brutally expensive.
Yeah.
So
probably got a lot of classics, which are great if you're into it, but I read those in comic book form when I was little.
But and they tend to be they tend to be stuff that's coming out right now, when in fact there's a whole body of stuff out there that badly needs to be, and it needs to be translated into Audible format, not for profit purposes, but for the fact that books have an intrinsic value, even for people who aren't well sighted anymore, and not everybody wants to run out and learn Braille.
It hit me when I was already pushing 60 real hard when this crap hit me. And they don't know why, and never will know why, probably. I was running a machine that was using a laser cutter, and I wonder, I was doing that for a friend of mine as a side income because the band was not doing what it was, what it used to do. I mean, it's time, and you know how music is, man. It comes and goes faster than, faster than a bottle of booze, I guess. But, yeah, that's what I think got me, and they don't know what causes macular problems. I wish the hell they did, but too late.
No, macular degeneration is frightening.
Yeah. It just hit me one morning. I woke up and said, man, somebody put Vaseline over my glasses? What the hell is this? You know? Hey, but you learn, Bob, you learn to live with what you've got. I don't like it. What burns me up the most is I'm looking around here for stuff, and these so-called health aids that work. In California, they work for the state. In Ohio, they work for these two-bit companies that some idiot sets up. And then they go out and they get...
I suspect those aren't idiots. Those,
no, they're not.
Those are entrepreneurial job creators, Bill.
Yes. And they don't pay these people anything. And I hate to say this, but when you don't pay somebody something and you're not really careful about who you hire, you got a lot of problems, potentially.
Oh, sure. By the way, note coming in from Jan and Jerry. They're out in Nevada. The note says the public library here has Audible books available. Great source.
Hmm. Well, that's how I get the stuff I get through the library. I just, I'm sitting waiting on waiting on one now that I've had a couple times, which is Max Hastings' History of Korea. I thought I had that around here, but it seems to have walked out. Because you never... It seems you never learn everything all at once. There's a detail that you miss. Hell, it wasn't. You couldn't read everything. Even when you were reading it with your eyes, you didn't catch everything.
Oh, see, I've just gone absolutely full tilt nerd for the last couple of nights reading that book, Zealot, by Reza Aslan. And I finished it last night. And it was very well written. And it was done in such a way as to... not be too dry and scholarly. Not that scholarly means dry. But I'm all geeked out over it. And you know, the mark of a good book is that it changes the way you think about things.
Yeah, for a while you're grabbed by the thing you're reading. You were talking earlier about talking about religion. Well, was Charles Martel the guy that supposedly stopped the invasion of France at Tours, wasn't that?
Yeah, Charles Martel.
Yeah, and of course, Vienna was under siege twice. Man, because some of those guys from the, what we would call Muslim armies, theoretically, I mean, because people grab power and then they use religion to hold it.
Sure, that goes back to what I was saying to Dr. John. When somebody's holy book says God told us to go and kill everybody and take their land,
yeah,
Usually that's an ex post facto justification that begins with, hey, that looks nice, like nice land. Why don't we take it?
Yeah, possibly.
See if God will let us. Oh, God said yeah.
Well, I think Buddhism is the only thing I can think of that doesn't have a long track record of some kind of conquest or the other, or some kind of animosity that leads to sharp blades or lots of bullets.
Right.
There's been a history of this. The whole thing is, you know, it goes back and forth and back and forth. And you watch the change when the Ottoman Empire fell apart, you know, at the end of World War One. Here come the British and French in to grab everything from Lebanon and Palestine. And I think the Saudi Arabians are the only ones that got away with their own country.
Well, no, that wasn't the Saudis at that point in time. That was the Hashemites, and they got Jordan, and they got what we now recognize. Well, they got the Arabian Peninsula, and they got Mesopotamia, and they sent different family members into different areas there. And then later on in the 20s, we supported the overthrow of the Hashemites in the Arabian Peninsula by the Royal House of Ibn Saud, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm not the strongest. I remembered reading in this one book, the Castles of Steel thing about the the British and German Imperial Navies in World War One, and the British were really taken aback when we sent some a couple of battleships over to Scapa Flow, and they were burning oil instead of coal. And
proved to be a real eye opener, didn't it?
Oh yeah, and the fact that Britain fought a war against what we would call Iraqis today.
They didn't have a moment's peace up until 1948 in that particular region, because the Hashemite king who was on the throne there was, of course, a client king.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because King Farouk in Egypt was nobody of any, you know, that was English, and that's it. That's the was.
And of course, the last Hashemite on the throne is the king of Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah, he would be. Didn't one of them marry an American woman? No, that was a Shah of Iran.
No, that's him. Well, he did too. But yeah, that's the king of Jordan.
Yeah, okay, one of them did. I know. I remember the guy from Thailand wanted to be a jazz saxophone player and loved the hell out of Louis Armstrong. But then again, who didn't when it came to his music was?
Yeah, but that reminds me of an old Latin proverb. Owning a horn does not make you a musician.
No. Well, believe me, I've heard enough of it.
I think it was Archimedes who was summoned to some royal court and told to teach geometry to the king's son, but to do it in such a way as to, you know, don't be too hard on the lad was basically the point.
Yeah.
And I think it was Archimedes who looked at him and said, "Sire, you have many royal roads. There's a royal road to Athens. There's a royal road to Corinth. But, sire, there is no royal road to geometry."
Man, okay. That was my big weakness. Although I took that high school exam and finished in the upper 10% in reading and comprehension, and didn't do too badly in math. I had to teach myself algebra because what I had, I went to one of the finest Roman Catholic high schools and was in the top class due to the entrance exam, and half the time I never showed up for class. I'd be downtown at the library in the history department with a pile of books and killing time reading something, Bob, because, you know.
Yeah, that's funny, because Dr. Bill mentioned today, and we had some transition difficulties, but it'll go up on the podcast. Dr. Bill mentioned today, remembering back to his youth, when the imprimatur on the book, you know, basically, this book is acceptable to be read by Roman Catholics.
Yeah, I remember that term, yes.
Yeah, the imprimatur. And I knew the word, but I didn't know the contextual meaning of it, that there was really a sort of blessed by the Holy See, it's okay, you can read this, there's no heresy in this.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Well,
the things I learned just sitting here and running Dr. Bill.
I spent a few years in a good old children's home with the, remember a nun cracking me across the face, and I'm measuring the distance from my left hand to her eyeglasses. And I was maybe 12 or 11 thinking, well, Bill, you'll go to hell, but oh well.
Oh, by the way, a little historic reminder coming in from Sandra via Twitter. Oh. She said, of course, there were the Buddhists in Myanmar.
Yeah, yeah.
They were more than willing to do a little warfare, or a lot of warfare, as the case may be.
I guess when there's money on the table or something else that people want, look out. Somebody's going to fight over it, and, you know, they'll take what you've got and nail with you. Yeah, that's true. There's too much of that, and that's been, I mean, the
20th. Well, I remember being absolutely sort of gobsmacked a few years ago when it turned out that, you know, arguably the most pacifistic religion on the Indian subcontinent is Jainism. You know, these are people who will literally not swat a mosquito, even if it's absolutely laden with malaria, yellow fever, you know, whatever. They won't swat a mosquito.
Well, I know some
And they, these people who are so reverential toward life itself, were so offended by and they don't eat meat. They're vegetarian by definition. So there was some sort of little eatery down the street in India that was serving up grilled meat.
Oh, boy.
And a mob of peace-loving Jains marched down the street, beat a few people half senseless, and burned the building to the ground.
Oh, well. They should believe in something, I guess. There was a song, The Universal Soldier, contained a reference, a piece of folk music that I heard a lot in the 60s. I forget the guy. The guy who did it was, I think, out of Cleveland at one point, or working out of Cleveland. God, The Universal Soldier. I was lucky. I got to see a lot of people that were... Buffy St. Marie, the a Native American singer, female, young woman, and...
Yeah.
Man, because she worked around Cleveland a lot, and I was pleased. Her stuff was good. Ah, you know, and what you guys were talking about earlier was... We said we go to the library, and Langston Hughes' books were something I read and was just, you know, it just catches your...
Well, I'll tell you what, if you can make some inquiries and get your hands on some of the stuff by Albert Murray in an audio format, I think it'd just be right in your wheelhouse.
Well, there was a woman in the projects who was out of the New York... What Renaissance? Feed me that again so I can remember what exactly the terminology was. She was out of New York, and she came, and she lived in the projects and taught music, and she had a group of kids working out of a place that was the Phyllis Wheatley Association owned the building, and she had these kids from every... Yeah, there was an Asian woman, so outside of Native Americans and Hispanics, everybody had a little representation in it, and these kids were all... Well, she made great singers out of kids that had the talent. My sister was a mezzo-soprano and a violinist and a pianist and opera star, and look what she had for a brother. Not a star, but, I mean, a local performer in these groups with youths. And she was very good. Well, her brother ends up... Well, what the blues singers would say, back in the alley, you know. But hell, it was the right time. I mean, the 60s was a time that culture was spreading in this country and really making the rounds of everybody. I mean, hell, I worked in the knitting shops with everybody in the hell, one of my supervisors, he had some numbers on his arm.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. And, hell, there was a guy from West Virginia. No, there was a couple from West Virginia. And there were folks, a lot of Euros were there, and many Black Americans. I had more fun. Those young guys would just take me to the cleaners with humor. You know, they were a little older than me, and they were giving it to me good. You know, they get into the SEX line and just say things that would bust me up as a 16-year-old who was, you know, the high school age kid that was working there trying to pick up a... And we got paid a whole dollar an hour when you started there, Bob.
And don't spend it all in one place.
On 1959, yeah. And
that wasn't a bad... 1959, that's not such a bad dollar.
No, but they'd work me in the summertime. They'd work me 60 hours a week at 17, you know. Maybe that's what drove me into music. I want a place where I don't have to work my head off. I enjoy what I'm doing. And I can have a taste and a drink and a funny cigarette with no name on it occasionally. In fact, The guy that was the singer with the Thunderbirds, Wilson, he came in one time. They had a cancellation on a Saturday, and he was told, go hear these guys. And I had him up there playing with me, much to he was so good, it made me, look for the exit. But then down the basement, we being broke, I was passing out the smoke with no name on it, no label, you know. We had a hell of a good time. It was a great business. Jobs in Detroit.
And didn't feel particularly criminal.
Hell no. My dad was arrested with that stuff in 1946. And luckily for him, his brother worked for the the guys that J. Edgar Hoover said didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, my uncle was a master mechanic for pinball and...
Benevolent and Protective Society, machines. I think.
Yes, absolutely. He could do all that stuff. They used to call him the man with the golden hands. He was an electronic technician, and I inherited a little of that, but not nowhere what he had. You know, you inherit from everybody in the family when you look around as your aunts, uncles, and what this guy can do and what the other guy can, and, you know, and plus, you know, your father's generation would have taught, you know, his sons and such and his daughters whatever he could teach them. That was part of the culture, too. You learn from people that were, you know, part of your family. But now families, I don't know. I'll let you go with this one. This is your. Give me your opinion. Do you think families are as tight as they were in the 40s?
Oh, by no means, because after the 40s, as Joe Bagent points out, the family gets deliberately deconstructed.
Yeah.
You know, deliberately.
Man, maybe you're right. I hate to be paranoid by looking at it that way, but I've thought about it.
No, the extended subsistence, rural subsistence family, at least, had to be deconstructed, had to be torn asunder, and moved into more urban settings to work in the factories to perpetuate the permanent post-consumer economic boom.
Yeah, and I'll tell you.
I mean, that's the difference between post-Second World War United States and pre-Second World War United States. It's not all just the Depression. It's the matter of how we go about being who we are. Because up until you can't view it as entirely a negative, because in post-Second World War America, you've got the FDR reforms beginning to kick in, and part of the extended family was the fact that when Grandma and Grandpa got to where they couldn't work anymore, well, that's when the next generation took over.
Yeah.
Because Grandma and Grandpa had nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. I remember years ago talking about the poverty numbers for elderly Americans pre-Social Security with Sandra, and they were shocking. They were a horror.
Yeah, I saw.
And when you see numbers like that, Bill. And you realize that the teabaggers and the Republicans and whatnot want to take us, you know, they like it when Granny starves. They're not kidding.
Yeah, they want to go back to the 1930 or 29, before the crash, of course, because their boys lost a lot of money, too, in that, some of their people. Yeah, and they don't teach you a damn thing. Nobody talks about Bush's grandparents and what they were involved in, and oh brother. And I went to John Birch Society meetings, and we did everything we could to drive the guy off the stage. I mean, you practiced up for that, for going down to the Woolworths when a guy was demonstrating some kitchen gadget and picking up every wise ass remark that he made, throwing it back at these 2-bit politicians. Anyway, I'll let you go, my friend.
All right, you have a good evening, Bill.
You take care.
Bye now. And we will keep things going. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Hey, Edward.
Well, I'll get off on another track. You were talking about Hattie McDaniel.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorites. And she did have a radio program that we always listened to. I mean, after supper, we just rushed in and so we could hear her program, and as I remember, it was called Beulah.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. And, now, somebody will correct me, but somewhere in my searching around somewhere in a library, I found that Hattie McDaniel was born in Wichita, Kansas.
I'll be darned. I had no idea.
Me either. So please correct me if I'm wrong. And that's all I have to say. You have a good evening.
All right. You too, Edward. You take care. Have a good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Edward calling from Dallas. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy. What's happening?
You conjured me yesterday by listening to the program this today at work.
Ah, sorry. Well, not really.
No. I'm continuously amused by the asshats on Fox News or anyone that takes any stance against some kid and what they're going to do. And furthermore, I don't mean this in any disrespect to anybody, and I understand there's a point to it, but just as homosexuals or any group of people, they want to be known as people, not as a category, not as trans people or transgender. They want to be seen as people. They don't want a label.
Yeah.
That's what...
The gays. The blacks.
That's what everyone seeks, is not to be put in these, for lack of a better term, goddamn labels of what you are.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, so many people are okay with those labels, but if you start talking about white folks, then they get a little bent. Well, what do you mean? What are you beating up on white folks for? Well, you caused white folks caused most of the problems in history. So I mean, just saying.
Right.
Or at least the history of Western European expansion into the Western Europe and the expansion into the Western Hemisphere. I mean,
yeah. And I particularly found that audio clip of that video played with that guy going to the college, trying to get all these people to come out and slam on.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, saying it's insane. Yet none of them would. But see, coming from where I come from, I hear things that other people don't necessarily hear. I heard them passing the ball off on their parents.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. Well, I think my parents would have a problem.
Right.
I mean,
they didn't
if it was my little sister, my mom and dad would have a fit.
Right. They didn't have the gumption to come out because somewhat society has changed to say it themselves. So they passed the blame and the scapegoat to their parents saying, well, my parents probably wouldn't like this. They're at college. Pretty much your parents either foot the bill or have very little to do with their life once you're in college. That's the point of college, to go grow up. So when they said things like, my parents wouldn't like this, or, well, maybe someone else's parents wouldn't like this, it's a cop-out. They didn't want to say they wouldn't like it. Now, bless that girl who came out and said that it won't work because that's the way our society is. That was a dead ringer. She was right.
If it fails, that will be why it fails, yes.
Right, if it fails, and that's what I think she was getting at, is if it fails, it's because society is that way. She was 100% correct and didn't falter or waver in her opinion.
Yeah. Well, it's like something Sandra just said to me via Twitter. She said, when someone says, now, no disrespect, she said, you know in that instant that something offensive is on its way.
Right, hence the goddess irony. I said no disrespect to all the horn listeners. I really meant that. I meant no disrespect when I said people want to be known as people and not categories.
Right.
But still, I understand that, yes.
Yeah.
So, getting off that subject for a second. Then we have Obama come out last week and say that America doesn't sanction the slaughter of civilians.
Yeah,
I
oops.
Swear he, yeah, it's one of those things where he's an educated guy. I realize he reads a lot of speeches. Sometimes speaks off the cuff, but you would think his writers would look into the irony of that statement with Hellfire missiles, atomic bomb, Apache helicopters chewing up five-year-olds, taking out a van full of people, and then going back over them three or four times to make sure they're all dead, even when they're crawling around dying.
Not dead enough quick enough.
Not dead enough quick, and then laughing and joking about how much fun it was while they were doing it.
Sure. It's like something Ron and Raleigh pointed out a couple of nights ago. The sentencing of Bradley Manning versus the sentencing of that guy who decided to off 12 Afghans for being Afghans. Who's going to have the harder time in Leavenworth?
or then those soldiers who peed on the bodies of dead Afghans who they claimed were insurgents.
Right.
You know? No, we don't know. They could have been normal people just protecting their own families. That's my favorite,
sure.
A lot of those people.
Oh, and Dr. John just wrote in with something. He said, great point about labeling people. He said, my apologies about doing it. That was in service of attacking the right-winger who did the awful broadcast. Yes, absolutely. And I don't think anybody was put off.
I don't think anyone meant anything bad, but I just want to put out there as a general thing. People don't want to be labeled. They want to be known as people. The biggest hope and dreams of anyone that's in my category of people, they just want to kind of fade into the background, not be noticeable, not be picked out, nothing like
that. And they just want their lives to be normal. Jeremy, did you happen to catch that clip of what is being referred to as the greatest segment ever on the Colbert Report?
No.
It turns out there's a little teeny tiny town in coal country, Appalachia, Kentucky, whose mayor is gay. And it turns out that under his mayorship, that little town of about 324 people has become the smallest town in America to pass a non-discrimination ordinance regarding sexual orientation. And it was done in typical Colbert style, you know, his faux O'Reilly kind of outrage. It was a segment called People Destroying America. And it was all about, and the reason I mentioned it, it was the exact opposite of what we heard seriously done by that goober at George Mason last night, because the Colbert people walked around town trying to get the locals to say that the town was going to hell on account of the homosexual mayor. And everybody could, he's the best mayor we've ever had. Great mayor, great. Until they finally found this pasty-faced, doughy old dude sitting in his Barca lounger with an oxygen tube running into his nose, who said, "The Lord don't approve of the gays." Talking about labeling. I was in Dallas one time. I was working, and I just walked into a bar. I wanted a beer, and it turned out it was a gay bar. And I mean, it was a gay bar. Did I tell you it was a gay bar? And it was hilarious. It was absolutely hilarious because the responses of the people were very similar to the responses of the people in the clip last night. What's the big deal? Right?
Right.
Only in this case, the part of the goober with the microphone was played by the goober with the oxygen tank. And no aspersions cast on anybody with COPD or anything. But, there he is, a Baptist minister talking about, I was in Dallas. I walked into a bar and to get a beer, and it's a gay bar. Oh, really? And they done things in there. And all of a sudden, you just expect the deliverance music. Just, sure, you've got a purty mouth. Because in addition to the deep-seated right-wing desire to categorize people, Jeremy, it is the deep-seated, it's both fear and fascination with a sexuality they don't understand because they can barely comprehend what passes for their own. Edna.
You asked before, is there any hope for humanity? And after you've seen a show like Honey Boo Boo, there isn't any hope for humanity.
Right, yeah.
June, they popularize these half-intelligent people and try to show, poor people can live good too.
Yeah, the phrase I saw for it, Jeremy, is poverty porn.
Right.
And it seems very deliberate because the article I read on it said, listen, this is a deliberate effort to make it look like people who are devastatingly poor are nonetheless having a happy time in the greatest country in the world. Now, I should probably use the reverb on that, but you get the idea.
Well, I don't know if you've seen this, but H2, they struck again. That'd be History International, it used to be called.
Oh, no.
But they gave Shelby from Axeman his own show. Now, bless Shelby. I think Shelby is a funny guy. I enjoy what he does. I enjoy his personality. But he is that exact, extreme poverty guy. But they twist it in this new season. They give him his own show, a 20-minute show every week. In, one of the first two episodes, he bought a new houseboat.
Oh, you see, I just happened to be near a running TV last week. and caught a couple of episodes of something called The Turtle Man.
That's not him.
No, no, no. But are you familiar with The Turtle Man?
No.
He's a Kentuckian who has a natural ability to go and ferret, probably poor choice of words, ferret out wild animals that have gotten into people's lives. And he cares about animals and doesn't just go up and, well, hell, I'm going to shoot it. He doesn't do that. You know, he chases out possums and big old scary snakes and foxes. But once again, the man lives in a shack deep in the woods, allegedly by choice. And you're just thinking, because it's presented as being a small thread in the rich tapestry that is America. When
right.
In fact, this guy ain't getting paid shit.
Right, and when this Shelby guy I'm talking about, and like I said, I like his character. I like, he probably really is that guy, but they play it for the camera. But he went out on this first episode of the new show to buy a new houseboat. Now, you think of a houseboat, you think of Louisiana, you think of something maybe dilapidated, run down, living in a swamp. He went out and bought an extra from Pirates of the Caribbean, a fully outfitted ship that was turned into a houseboat. The price was, I think, $740,000.
Wow.
Now, and we're talking masts and all, cannons, it was all.
Oh, I know, and two nights from now, the third or fourth episode of Hatfields and McCoys, White Lightning, will come on, and I caught the first episode and forgot the next one, and maybe I forgot a second one, but I got to tune in out of a sense of morbid, grim, perhaps mordant fascination, just to see what is once again being done by way of portraying poor folks in Appalachia. And see, that's the funny thing. I know one of the cast members. And he's not some poor, ignorant guy. This guy's got a college degree.
I stayed away from that show for respect for all the Virginians. West Virginia, Virginia, you name it. I don't want to see it because I know how badly they screwed up the Hatfield McCoy's movie, even though it was the highest rated movie since they made Gettysburg.
Oh, well. Yeah.
Which was war porn in the end. Really.
Oh, sure it was. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I'll let someone else talk because I got to do some other stuff. But,
all right,
but
Jeremy, you have yourself a good evening. And I know I'm raising hell with your duct tape and tennis ball budget. I'll see if I can do something about that and cut back.
It's all good.
All right, later.
Yeah, bye.
Jeremy calling from Vermont. Twitter, a note in. ouch. A note in from Sandra. Ferrets? Kentucky? Turtle Man? I thought you were going to say Mitch McConnell. Probably should have oughta. The Angry Indian is with us on the Skype line. Hey, Angry.
Hey, Bob. What's going on, man?
I don't know, man. What's happening?
Well, I don't know. I'm listening to your callers, and, you know, it's just interesting. You know, I'm listening, and it's cool because I try to explain to a lot of folks who, and I have to be clear here. You know, there's a generality that I hear that really needs to be discussed. And what I mean by that is that when you hear a lot of folks say, well, you know, people don't want to be labeled, and we all just want to be accepted. Well, that's true, but the argument, the majority of the argument, the brunt of the argument, though, is coming from a completely Eurocentric background. Because they're making an assumption that if you're equal with us, then you don't need to have any label. Which then makes my history as an indigenous person, it makes it null and void. My history as a person of African descent, it makes it null and void. You know, in other words, you know, my background should never be mentioned. You know, I should just be who I am today, and whether or not I can walk into a department store and buy an alligator purse like Oprah and be treated equally.
Oh, God, not the Oprah purse story, please.
Well, there's Whitney Houston and an alligator purse, I heard recently. Morrissey, the British singer who now lives in Hollywood, Morrissey,
yeah,
has been going back and forth about that. But what I'm trying to say is, or at least what I want to get across, and again, I shouldn't have to say this, but I feel like I need to say this. You know, I want to be recognized as a person of color. I want to be recognized as a descendant of slaves, because that is my history. I want to be recognized as an indigenous person whose blood is in the soil of this ground before any European ever walked here. I'm not ashamed of being an Ilocano from the Philippines and having that descent. And I refuse to be ashamed for being part Ashkenazi Jew. You know, I mean, I want to be recognized for my history. Now, whether or not I should be judged on the stereotypes of that, but then we have to ask, where did the stereotypes come from in the first place? And my question is the same thing that Jean-Paul Sartre had. You know, he asked the French when they were dealing with colonialism in Algeria. Can the Frenchman, can the European condemn himself? You know, when Europeans say, okay, let's just have an even playing field, I'm cool with that. But then the thing about it is, the list, you know, when we say that, are we saying, oh, are we going to ignore the history of slavery? And
well, and not just that. It's one thing to have an even level playing field, but that depends entirely on who's laying the playing field out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we can make the same argument with Africa, because a lot of folks in the African community are not particularly happy with me when it comes to discussions about Vodun or traditional African beliefs, or pagan, if you will, and homosexuals, especially because homosexuals are part of the religious fabric of Africa. They are part of the religious fabric of most indigenous societies. Of course, it's not a uniform thing. I mean, everybody has their particular different histories that have to do with their geography and what have you. But, you know, we really need to be careful about telling people to, you know, throw away their history simply so they can fit into the current meme at the time, especially when we're dealing with a meme that's being set by the corporate sector. It, you know, I mean, Obama's president, not because he's a black person or because America has finally woken up.
Post-racial, please.
President because he is a white, a black man that pretty much thinks like a white man. And he is the face for all of the wrongs that, you know, if we want to get into a partisan thing when it comes to racism.
Oh,
he
has sure, because if it was not for the fact, I mean, if America was completely comfortable with the idea of a black man in the White House, and I'm getting some something sending back at me from you, I don't know what it is, but, you know, we would have been saying President Jesse Jackson half a generation ago.
No, we would have been saying President Shirley Chisholm a long time ago. She talked about Appalachia, Bob, when nobody was talking about Appalachia in D.C., you know, and she was a West Indian, a black woman. And she was like, well, hey, what about these people? And they're like, what about them? And they said, well, what about them? Well, hey, you know, the country isn't particularly strong if these folks are not giving us the basic, you know, amenities of what citizenship is, you know, a part of. She talked about everybody. She brought up homosexual issues and, you know, transgender things way before, back in the 70s, before anybody else. But she was just too black and too female for even the black congressional caucus, who stood against her because, well, who supports them and the fact that she was a woman. And she just asked too many questions, and it went with McGovern.
Wow.
You know, and in terms of Hattie McDaniel, yeah, I mean, she is one of those folks in Hollywood, and I can't really remember a lot of the names right now. There was a protest led where he had just about every black person in America who owned the TV in the 50s to turn their television off in protest of the racism that was going on, I believe, at CBS. And Bob, you're older than me. You must remember when Harry Belafonte, was it Dusty Springfield or... And I named on my show, I can't remember her damn name right now, but I can't remember exactly who it was. But he was doing a duet, I believe it was NBC, and she touched his arm, and they finished the duet. And they got mail, and you know, they got hate mail for years behind that. And I knew white folks who refused to watch NBC because of that. And that wasn't that long ago. So when we talk about
Harry Belafonte and Petula Clark.
It was Petula Clark, that's right, yeah, because I mentioned her on my show, thank you. And, you know, and I said, you know, I remember people being upset about that, and I remember black folks saying, well, you know, I can see how it could be a bit of a shock, but they were singing, and they're two professional singers, and did they really think that he was going to grope her on on live television. You know, I mean, we have a lot of fantasies that are brought on because of colonialism, that are brought on because, and I can talk about this in terms of Christian religion. And you know, I mean, there's just so many aspects to this.
Oh, sure. And just because you mentioned it, somewhere out in the in the Hornosphere, somebody has said Mandingo.
Mandingo, yeah. Well, that film was just a little too rough for a lot of people.
No, but the whole idea that underpins American culture, especially in the South, that they're good. I mean, the level of white male insecurity that allows for the rise of something like they're coming for our white women.
Which would be interesting, but as I've said on my show, and I think you and I have even talked about this between our shows, they don't give a damn about white women. Look at what they're doing in Texas. Look at how they treat women who carry condoms in New York City. Look at how women are being treated in the military. They don't give a damn about white women either.
Oh, amen. And the whole point behind that, Angry, is the fact that they don't want anybody else sharing in the control of women. That
exactly.
is the, you know, that's that whole plantation mentality.
That's why the
privileged pecking order.
Folks, you know, because they, I mean, that deals directly with slavery. Here you had black women who were freed now during Reconstruction, and Mr. Charlie, for lack of a better term, would say, hey, come around. That's where the whole idea of the white man giving a black woman a red dress, that he pretty much owns her, that's where that came from. The pimp was the black man that came around and said, look, the next time you go up to see Mr. Charlie, you ask him for something. You take some money back. You take a couple of gold coins from him. That's how pimping got started. Those were the black men that were going from town to town that were had their own carriages and that were well-dressed, because prostitution was not considered a bad thing back in those days. And as long as they stayed within that particular role, they were safe. And as we start to move into the 20th century, 21st century, and so on, you just brought it up. The mythology of it is that these black men have control over so many white women, and that's scary.
And at the same time, uncontrollable animal sexuality.
Sexuality, you know, it's just too much. And that's where Mandingo comes in, and the follow-up Drum. And remember, they used Ken Norton to make that film.
Oh, God, I'd forgotten. Hey, Angry, I'm sorry we didn't have as much time as I'd like to have. Chime in any time. And if you want to, at some point, we'll work out this audio loopback so that we'll have, because your audio is awesome. I've just got stuff feeding back at me, and we get that sorted out. It'll all be perfect.
All right, I'm sorry about that.
Oh, hey, don't apologize. We'll talk soon, all right?
All right, bye.
Take care now.
All right.
Bye now. Yeah. Our buddy, the Angry Indian. Just look up Radio Angry Indian, and you can find his wildly enjoyable, thought-provoking podcast. It's time to get out of here. Really time to get out of here. Thanks for a lot of engaging conversation this evening. I really appreciate it all. We will close the evening. $95 to go to meet Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Hopefully that'll happen overnight so that we won't have a bigger hole to climb out of tomorrow. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Time to get out of here. Rick Smith is on the way on the horn. Night, y'all.